Well, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays, everyone. In this encore show, my featured guests this week, Peter Schiff, David Nikoski, Jeffrey Christian, and Gary Dorsch. Next week, an all-new show with the forecaster himself, Martin Armstrong. Well, we're so glad you've chosen GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and news information source. Today's featured guest, Jeffrey Christian from CPM Group. Jeffrey Christian, managing partner of CPM Group. It's been several years since we've had him on the show. He's a prominent analyst and advisor in the commodities and precious metals sector for several decades now, well known within the financial community. Welcome back, Jeffrey Christian.
Hey, it's great to be back, Chris.
Before the show, you mentioned that you're recently back from South Africa, that you have some interesting contacts there in the mining sector. Tell us more, please.
Well, actually, we go there at least twice a year, and sometimes it's three or four times a year. We have a number of clients there, mining companies and gold and platinum, government offices, and also a lot of institutional investors who take our research and advisory work. So at least twice a year, I go down there. Last week, I think I saw about 21 institutional investors. We spent a day with a gold mining company. We spent several hours with another gold mining company and quite a bit of time with some of the platinum producers down there, telling them what we're seeing, what our view is as to why the markets are going where they are and where we think they're going to go on the short-term and on the long-term basis.
Well, you know, I think we forget sometimes that South Africa is a member of the BRICS conglomerate of nations. In 2006, you penned Commodities Rising. It was certainly well-timed, but there has been quite a sea change since that point, since 2011, just an abysmal, tough, and challenging time for the sector. Can you give people an idea of where we are in the correction in the commodities sector?
Yeah, what we've been saying really since 2006 or so, I guess, in 2005, 2006, what we were saying was that, you know, the commodities super cycle was nonsense. It was just marketing hype. There was an upward shift in investment and industrial demand for commodities, which was pushing prices higher, that we would get into a cyclical correction within a longer-term secular bull market. And from what CPM Group's analysis tells us now is that we're probably 3 years into that cyclical correction in commodities, and we might have a couple more years to go. Short-term perspective and medium-term perspective, we expect continued weakness in demand and prices for a lot of commodities. We think most of the decline is behind us, and the prices will just more move sideways than downward further. And then in a couple years, you know, by late 2017, early 2018, what you might see is a major change in investor perceptions of risks on a governmental and an economic and a financial level, which could lead to a renewed upward bull market in these commodities, coinciding with a downturn in supply due to the period of low prices that we're going through now.
So you don't see the shift in mentality at the FOMC to a more hawkish stance, if you will. They're just reacting to the market? They're not actually pulling the strings?
I don't think the Fed pulls the strings. And in fact, I think the Fed has lost an enormous amount of market power and respect over the last couple of years, because it's been, you know, talking about raising interest rates really for a theoretical reason, not because the economic trends and conditions in the U.S. economy suggest it. You know, they're trying to restart lending to small and medium-sized businesses and households, but they're doing it in what I think is a totally inappropriate way. And it's not just me. I think a lot of people are looking at the Fed over the last couple of years and saying the Fed has really not been playing its cards well. So I think that the Fed is following economy, and, you know, related to that, we have been saying that we thought it'd be a smaller later increase in interest rates, and now we're saying it's going to be smaller and later, as is everybody else. But in addition to that, they might just sort of come back and say, look, things have changed with the Chinese change in monetary policy, with the volatility in the markets, and what seemed to make sense a couple of years ago about raising interest rates just may not make sense going forward. So they might just back off completely. I don't think they will, because I think that they're going to try to save face as much as they can. And I don't think that, you know, my view is, you know, let's be honest and just come clean and get on with it. Their view probably is going to be to make some small changes. But even if you look at what they were saying that they were planning, which was, you know, a series of 25 basis point increases in interest rates over a couple of years, if you look at what they expect, they're looking at interest rates of about 2.8% by the end of 2017. You know, inflation will be about 2%. That means that real interest rates will be 0.8%. That's not enough to either accomplish what they say they want to accomplish, nor to entice investors out of other markets. I mean, 0.8% real interest rates, 2.8% nominal rates, that's not going to cause people to say, oh, I feel comfortable investing in interest-bearing treasuries at this point. So I think that their policy is ill-conceived, and I think that they realize it now, too, and that's one of the reasons why you're seeing the dollar fall as sharply as it is over the last several trading days.
And so you then wouldn't attribute that to lowered expectations of the rate hike at the September and December FOMC meetings?
Oh, no, it's definitely occurred. I mean, if you go back 2 weeks ago before the Chinese announcement, I think the probability rating in the market on the CME's interest rate hike chit-chat board was something like 54% chance of an interest rate hike in September. We were saying we thought it probably would come in December. But within like a week of the changes in Chinese monetary policy, that had dropped down to like 28%. And the majority of people are now saying that they expect an interest rate hike in December. Given the market volatility, I think it would be extremely inappropriate for the Fed to increase interest rates in September. And the market seems to agree with that view.
Firstly, I'd say I think the situation is ambiguous because on the one hand, we see much better unemployment numbers. We see a somewhat tame inflation figure. We've had a solid housing recovery as witnessed in the HGX Philadelphia Housing Index. These, I think, are key metrics that the Fed officials and governors are watching closely. You know, now that we've reached their targets for the most part, I think they'd like to see a little more inflation. It would seem as though they have the wiggle room required to pull the trigger on a couple, at least, of rate hikes. But I've seen the numbers you're referring to, too. At the upper end of their forecast, they're talking as high as 3.25% in the years coming forward on those rate hikes. And that I just find very difficult, given the tenuous state of the domestic economy. And give us an idea of how this could affect the precious metals sector on a forward basis, please.
You know, the first thing is if you're looking at the Fed delaying or even abrogating its plans to raise interest rates, that's good for gold. And we've seen that in the, you know, $100 increase in gold prices from the trough to the peak over the last few weeks. So I think that's good. But, you know, gold ultimately, in my mind, responds to uncertainty and volatility in the world, whether it's economic or financial market or monetary or political. And what I think you're moving into is a much more volatile period for financial markets, for currencies, and a lot greater amount of uncertainty. The volatility is based on uncertainty about where the world's going, where China's going, where Europe is going. You know, you've had some diminution of risk, and, you know, people have realized that Greece's debt renegotiations is nothing more than a debt rescheduling. It's not the end of Europe or anything. But you've seen an increase in risk in China, in the United States, and on a global basis that I think trumps the Greek movement toward a resolution of its debt situation. So I think that what you're finding is that investors will probably be much more interested in gold going forward than they have been over the last couple of years. If you go just looking at the Chinese stock market, Chinese stock market dropped 25% in June, but Chinese investors did not bail out and buy gold. What they did is they bought stocks, because even after it had fallen 25%, it was still up 85% from a year earlier. Now you're seeing the stock market down even more. It's gone to a lower level than it was in June. And, you know, we're waiting to hear from our Chinese clients. We want to know if Chinese investors are taking the current sell-off and the current recent devaluations and prospects for further devaluations of the yuan as an opportunity to get out of stocks and start buying gold. That's what they did back in 1993 when the government was moving to devalue the yuan, and that's what they may do again. We don't have insights as to what the Chinese investors are doing right now. We hope to have them in 24 hours or so. But, you know, the thing is that in June, they took a sell-off in the stock market as a buying opportunity for stocks. And at some point, they're going to say, you know what, this isn't a short-term drop in a speculative bull market. This is the end of the bull market. And when that comes, especially tied in with the yuan devaluation, I think the Chinese investors will return to gold, and they'll return in volume.
Then you're not one of these who expects a repeat of the 1980s and 1990s in the precious metals sector.
Well, it's a repeat in that there's a cyclicality there, but I don't think, you know, if you look at the 19, you know, I think what we're looking at is a repeat of the period 1997 to 2002. As opposed to a repeat of the period 1980 to 2002. You know, you were in a very broad downward market, sideways to lower market across commodities for 22 years there. I don't think that we're looking at 22 years of boring or downward commodity prices. I think we're looking at 5 years, which is, as I said, we see it as a cyclical decline in a secular bull market. And I think so, you know, we're looking at, like I said, 2 years, 3 years from now, we're looking at a number of commodity prices starting to rise, gold in particular, for a variety of reasons. So that's sort of the historical model that we're looking at.
Okay. Let's move over to the energy sector. West Texas Intermediate Crude has fallen out of a multi-year, 5-6 year consolidation after a huge run to, what was it, close to 140, 145. And now it has really started to pick up some momentum on the downside in recent weeks. Some folks are calling for a $20 target. Give us an idea of your feeling on the sector, please.
Right now I'm wrong, because I said on Chinese internet television 2 weeks ago, I think prices around $40 are the base, and you know we're down to about $38 or so right now. You know, clearly they can spike down. I think that oil is going to be a good buy at some point, but I'm fascinated by the oil industry right now, because you have a series of short-term and long-term factors, all of which are up for redefinition. So you have short-term changes in supply rising. You have short-term changes in demand, where new technologies like LED lighting and other efficiencies are reducing the per unit and per capita electricity and energy requirements. And then you have short-term political events. You have, you know, definite commodities war. You know, the Cold War between the U.S. and Russia is clearly being reflected in lower oil prices. Political animosity between the United States and Saudi Arabia and Iran is clearly being reflected in Saudi and U.S. oil policies. You know, you've got a lot of political and economic factors as well as market fundamentals. And then you also have a big series of long-term changes, political, economic, financial, but also fundamentals. You know, I started off in 1975 in university. The first commodity I studied was the oil market. And in 1975, we were coming out of the 1973 oil embargo. OPEC had flexed its muscles for the first time. You had a tremendous increase in oil prices during the oil embargo in 1973 into early 74, threw us into a pretty nasty recession. And what you had in 1975 is what you have in 2015. You have an energy complex that is entirely up for redefinition. You've got fracking and shale oil recovery. You have the internationalization of the natural gas market and a tremendous increase in natural gas supply and demand. You have a revival of interest in nuclear power. Solar and wind are now cost competitive and are taking big strides around the world. I believe that, like Iowa, has, for example, about a third of its electricity comes from wind power now, and it expects to be at 50% of its electricity coming from wind power in a couple of years. And then on the demand side, you have new technologies, which are, again, further reducing per unit of GDP and per capita energy requirements. So the whole energy complex seems, you know, up for a major redefinition. It'd be a fascinating time to be, you know, a full-time oil analyst at this point, because I think everything is up for change. And what that means for oil prices, I do not know. I don't think they're going to go to $20. I think they could spike down there, but I'm a buyer probably at anything below 40.
No, I am as well. And I wonder then if you are factoring in this economic downturn, or at least sluggishness that we're seeing in Shanghai, Peking, and China, or at least maybe looking forward to a time as we start to see economic indicators turn up, as a great time to start adding energy-related investments to the portfolio.
Absolutely. I mean, look, we are worried. Our view is that China has gone through some cyclical and secular changes, that the GDP has fallen to 6.5%, 7.5% level. We think that the Chinese government has the capacity to maintain growth there, so we're not necessarily looking for Chinese growth to slow significantly further. But, you know, China, like the rest of the world, is up for redefinition. They clearly have accelerated their move to a convertible yuan. They're not there. And then domestically, they went from a centrally planned economy to a centrally managed economy, and now they're going to something less managed than it was. And they realize they have to do that because of the growth in the Chinese economy and the number of economic players there. And that's a tremendous amount of uncertainty with big tensions within the Chinese Communist Party leadership, because quite frankly, you know, their view has always been, we'll give you economic liberalization as long as you don't ask for political liberalization. And there are people, political scientists, who say, no, it doesn't work that way. It, you know, as people develop economically, they demand more political liberalization, and that's going to have to happen. And there are people within the Chinese Communist Party who say, we must not let that happen. But then there are other people, including the president, who say, we have to let it happen, and we have to manage it as best as we can. So it's a fascinating time to watch what's going on there.
As this dialogue winds down, if you could put together a hypothetical portfolio for investors, let's say over the next year or two, would you mind filling in the blanks, please?
That's hard to say, and it really depends on what, you know, the financial position of an individual investor. But, you know, I think that a good portfolio would probably be poised to take positions, you know, in stocks, bonds. I wouldn't get into bonds that much. I just don't quite understand the bonds. I have a large amount of my own funds in cash right now. I do have stocks, and I'll be looking to add to the stock market position as soon as I feel that the current spasm is over. And when I say the current spasm, I think that you will see a rebound in a few days in many stock markets, but that the market could move to newer lows in September and October. So I'm not looking for a really stronger stock market probably until November or December. So I might be nibbling, and I might be buying a long S&P ETF over the next few days or a couple weeks, but I probably wouldn't look to increase my long position in the stock market until November, December. And I should, you know, be honest, I also been trading short S&P ETFs. I bought some in the second quarter with the expectation that the market would move downward, and I've liquidated some of that position to take profits today, actually, but I still have some of that short position there. In the commodities markets, I like gold. I'm a little bit worried about silver, but it is incredibly low. Platinum and palladium, they may not move up sharply for a year or two, but I think from a longer-term perspective, they're interesting. Gold, the same thing. I'm not necessarily looking for it to fall to 1,000. I'm not necessarily looking for it to go to 1,300 in the next couple quarters. Longer term, beyond 2017, I wouldn't be surprised to see gold prices move sharply higher, especially depending on what happens with the U.S. presidential election. Oil prices, again, I think below $40, they're a buy. I wouldn't try to buy them right now. I'm waiting to see the price and the global financial market stabilize, but then I'll probably be an oil buyer. Copper I like a little bit. I'm not as wildly optimistic as some people, but I do think it could rise too.
Anything that we've not covered today that you'd like to share with the listeners? Perhaps some topicality or something in your writings or any anecdote that you've picked up you'd like to share with folks today?
In terms of gold, because I guess GoldSeek probably is more interested in gold than other things. I mean, one of the things that we've seen over the last 2 months, July and August, have been a couple of announcements by the People's Bank of China. They have made a major long-term structural change in their attitudes toward gold. They have announced a large addition to their monetary reserves in July as of June, and then they announced that they bought another 600,000 ounces in July. And I think that that is a very important factor because it represents a major central bank with a lot of other central banks that respect it, making a, like I said, long-term structural change in its attitude to be more pro-gold.
They're trying to convince the IMF that the yuan is worthy to be part of the reserve currency basket. So by, you know, increasing transparency there from, what was it, 5 or 6 years without letting anyone know their game plan on the precious metals, now to, it looks like they're changing to perhaps monthly announcements in order to cajole the IMF and convince them that this is a worthwhile currency.
Actually, yeah, the IMF guidelines are for its members to report its monetary reserves on a monthly basis. And actually, the Chinese government, the People's Bank, has been doing that. But what they've been doing is, as they buy gold, they put it into a special account. And then they have, at least up until July, they would put it into a special account. And then every so often, they would add that special account gold to their monetary reserves. And yeah, with the announcement in early August, that they had added 600,000 ounces in July, that suggests that they will now conform to the IMF guidelines and report adjustment changes on a monthly basis. And it also suggests that they've moved away from that pooling metal in a special account and then adding it to monetary reserves, that they may actually move to a practice of buy the gold, add it to the reserves. There are some reasons why the central bank didn't do that in the past and why it made its announcement in 2009 that it had bought metal from 2003 to 2009 and why they held it aside until June of this year. And by the way, most of the gold, I think, that they announced and added to monetary reserves in June, I think most of that gold was probably bought in 2013 and 2014 and not in 2009, 10, 11, 12. Just from what we've seen in the Chinese market. But yeah, they want to be they realized after 2008 they need to be more assertive on an international monetary stage, and they are moving in that direction.
Do you have any comment on the speculation that may or may not be founded? The People's Bank of China may be covertly accumulating more than is announced, or is that just hearsay?
It's hearsay, and it's primarily put out by people who sell gold to investors to try to encourage them to buy more gold. And if our analysis of the gold flows into, around, and out of China suggests to us that the People's Bank probably is not accumulating these massive amounts that some people do. We did in our gold yearbook, we had a discussion where we showed how gold trades in in China through the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and we showed how people can overestimate by 200-300% the amount of gold that's coming into the market because they don't understand the flow of gold within the gold market and the Shanghai Gold Exchange. So if you look at the outturn or the gold taken off of the SGE and you don't understand what you're looking at and the production of new scrap and reprocessing of it, you would overestimate it. And I think that that's what's been going on, although I think that the people who have done it, many of them are fully aware that they're inaccurate, but they're trying to find reasons to convince Western investors to buy gold in the middle of a bear market. And I think they latched on that as a story to promote. So, no, I don't buy that.
Jeffrey Christian, I wonder if you could tell people more about the services that CPM Group provides, including your commodities management, asset management, hedging opportunities for folks who have large exposure to the sector. You have consulting, financial advisory. Give them an idea, run the gamut here of what you can do to help our listeners today.
Sure. Well, we are a research-driven company. Our raw materials are research and analysis, and then we sell that. And for a lot of investors, probably the premier thing is to buy our gold or silver or platinum group yearbooks. They're like $180. They can find out about all this stuff at our website, which is cpmgroup.com. You can buy the reports either as e-books or as hard copies or as both on our website. Then what we do is after we have that research and analysis, we sell it in various forms. So research, we'll sell reports. We work as advisors for investors, usually large net worth individual investors or institutional investors. We work for our, you know, mining companies, processors, refiners, smelters, users, financial intermediaries, central banks, governments. We provide our research to anybody who has a large exposure in precious metals or commodities, and they want to know where we think the market's going and why. And you can, there are a bunch of free reads at our website. If you go to our market views at our website, there are a lot of reports and presentations that people can read to give them a flavor of the kind of fundamental and macroeconomic research that we do.
Jeffrey Christian, thanks for taking time from the busy schedule, and we hope that you will return to GoldSeek.com later on in 2015 and in 2016.
Anytime.
All right, you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's special guest, David Nikoski from Vermilion Capital. My featured guest today ranks in that rare category of why didn't we ask them on the show before now? It's a pleasure to welcome David Nikoski, head of Vermilion Capital Management, chief technical strategist. Welcome, David Nikoski.
Chris, I appreciate it.
I wonder if you might give us an overview of volatile markets. We haven't seen anything quite like this since 2008. You have a substantial background professionally in the technical arena, and we have just so many technical analysts listening to our voices. Give us an idea, just what you see, starting with U.S. equities.
We saw this pattern once before. We had highlighted the similar pattern back in May 4th of 2010. What you have is a pattern. If you think of behavioral economics, what you tend to see is, you know, human patterns repeat themselves. And oftentimes these patterns are put onto a chart. And in this case, what we saw was a diamond pattern. And the same pattern, like I said, took place back on May 4th of 2010 and in 29, exactly. So, and I guess when we look at kind of history, we may see the patterns back in the past. And I think what you're seeing today is the markets move much faster. When I started in the business back in 87, and I actually got laid off in the stock market crash of 87, so through experience, you know, one thing that we had back then is we didn't have the trading systems that we do today. So the market's much faster, but you still get the patterns that still present themselves. And it shows human emotion, fear, and greed. And on this pattern that we saw, this diamond pattern. If you break to the downside, you can have explosive moves to the downside. You had that after March 4th of 2010 or May 4th of 2010, and you just most recently had this pattern occur on Wednesday of last week. So to us, it wasn't a complete shock. We highlighted the pattern and saw it breaking to the downside, and the subsequent days are obviously where you get the most chaos. Where we are sitting right now in terms of the market is we're going to have volatile trading periods, and you're going to walk in one day and feel great. The next day, you're going to be down several hundred points. These quant systems, they'll turn on and off, and these are things that you didn't have in the past, but you see the markets get a lot more volatile during these corrective periods than we've seen ever in the past. I think we're in for kind of a bumpy ride, and as more news flows comes in, the market will respond accordingly in dramatic fashion.
Well, I certainly concur. I'm getting proprietary oversold. I find it very interesting that you identified the diamond pattern. I think there in the S&P 500, there was a complex head and shoulders pattern, two of my favorites for tops and bottoms. Interestingly, inverted head and shoulders are probably my favorite to get me into the trends. I'd like to talk about just what we've seen happen. Last week, at least on a point, not percentage basis, less than 6% in the Dow on the downside, over 1,000 points. Interestingly, though, on Monday, intraday, roughly 1,000-point swing, ending at about 588 on the Dow Jones Industrials average. I'd like your thoughts on what traders and investors can take away from that type of volatility. I mean, obviously, you've pointed to quants. You're looking at the algorithmic trading that so many of us are involved in, robotic trading and whatnot. That takes the individual out of it, so there's no emotion. Do you think that this is going to have a negative overall impact, or are the markets just a self-clearing, invisible hand?
You know what? I think it does take away confidence from investors because what they realize is that the market, in many cases, are actually not trading on fundamentals. And I, as a technician, you know, that's my job, is not to pay as much attention to the fundamentals as I should to trends. And the problem is, you know, technicals work great, you know, and relative strength is what is the theory that we subscribe to here at Vermilion. And relative strength works great 98 to 99% of the time. It's that 1% of the time where you get these cataclysmic shocks that all of a sudden relative strength really doesn't matter. And when I say it doesn't matter, I don't mean that it truly doesn't matter. What I'm saying is that you will take out the strongest areas of the market for the last leg or the capitulatory decline. And more recently, what you've seen is obviously in the last month and a half, you've seen a lot of the semiconductor-related stocks take it on the chin. You've seen the biotechs, which surprisingly on Friday of last week, despite a weak tape, the XBI, which is a biotech index, was actually positive. For a decline on the Dow of 500 points, that's pretty amazing, even though there's not really a correlation between the Dow and biotechs. But one would think that you would have a weak tape across everything, especially those areas that are most speculative. So I do believe that, you know, again, we're going to be in for a volatile period. I think technicals are a tool in the arsenal toolbox, but I do think that this algorithmic trading and the quant type trading, when it does go awry, it really goes awry. And if you look back in history at some of the biggest quant type of disasters or system trading, long-term capital, 98, perfect one. You saw this also take place back in the decline of 08 and 09. A lot of these systems were shut off. A lot of major brokerage firms actually shut down their quant systems because they had to keep funding them through the decline because they were popping on and off, and that's what created a lot of the volatility in 08 and 09.
I'd like to move on to just how this might impact the Fed. The ECB and several other colleagues around the world are going to continue with their quantitative easing. The Fed claims the FOMC will more than likely raise by 0.25% the benchmark lending rate next month in September, and then perhaps once again in December. I'd like to hear your thoughts on whether or not you buy their rhetoric and just how that might impact our listeners' portfolios.
I'm in the camp that I don't believe their rhetoric. I think they want to stand firm. They want to show that they're in control, and I think that's in essence what they're trying to communicate to the general public. I don't think that the market can right now handle an increase, especially with what we see going on around the world. And one of the reasons that, you know, we have very low interest rates here aside from the quantitative easing, is that when you look at European yields on their treasury bonds, Germany's yielding 73 basis points. The U.S. is at 2.1%. The European Central Bank is actually charging banks for their reserves. So what they're doing is they're actually coming over here and buying treasuries and pushing our interest rates down just in order to collect the differential between the U.S. yield and the German yield. And I think that's creating, in my view, a bond bubble here. And remember, bubbles can stay intact for a long time. So could we go lower or can we go slightly higher? I think the jury is out. You know, if we break through, you know, a 2.6% level, then we're going to see a secular change in interest rates. But as of now, we're staying much lower than anyone could have possibly imagined 3, 4, or 5 years ago.
On to the government intervention issue. We hear of circuit breakers virtually across the board in the Shanghai Index. On the one hand, we see essentially the markets supported by their officials, which seems admirable. I mean, at least on paper, it looks really good. But I think the flip side of this is 8, 9, 10% correction in a day or a matter of days following 30, 40% losses, I think is indicative of structural weakness. We nearly saw circuit breakers come into play in the New York Stock Exchange on Monday, another 0.5%, maybe 1% or so, and circuit breakers would have been triggered. Give us an idea whether you see it as a positive or a negative.
I think that, you know, when you move something down so far, so fast, you're eventually going to get a reflex rally. There's no doubt that they're in a secular bear over there. I think a lot of that weakness and a lot of the substandard growth that you're getting out of China that everyone expected, as a believer in relative aspect of everything in the world, being a technician studying relative strength, I think what you really have is you have, for the last several decades, you've had China stealing market share on away from Japan and some of the other Asian countries. And I think what you've done is you flipped that switch where the Japanese yen has now weakened so dramatically against currencies around the world. Japan is in a secular bull market. And I think that's what you see is the baton being handed from one region to another. And I think Japan, on a long-term basis, is a screaming buy. The question is how much do we pull back here? We're still, you know, weighing through the charts and looking to see, look for an entrance, an opportunity to enter Japan once again. Not that we're out of it. We've recommended an overweight for a couple of years. I think I'll be there for, you know, a decade. I don't marry a lot of fundamental work with my technical. I track every market around the world, and I break it down into a sector, a geographic region, sector, a group. Based upon how we view the market, not based upon S&P groups or JIX codes. One of the things that we found in our group is that when you look at some of these JIX codes or S&P groups, you have companies like Ford and AutoZone in the same group. I can't study a group with companies that I believe actually are not competitors. So by graphing, and what we did was we went back and collected all the data going back to 1970 on every stock that's ever traded, whether it's bought out, bankrupt. I have over 30,000, almost 30,000 stocks in my U.S. database. What that gives me is it doesn't give me the survivorship bias. And one of the things that I think that many tech nations gravitate to is when they focus on popular indices, I think they're doing an injustice to the value that a sector or a group adds to the market. And let me give you an example. When you look at the S&P 500 today from 2000 and comparing it to today's S&P 500, what most people don't realize is you have about 180 names that have changed in that index from 2000. You're not looking at the same index you did back then. One of the things that you see with, for example, the Dow, here you add a stock called Apple to it. In 2000, you added Microsoft and Intel to the Dow. The Dow was never meant to be a technology-laden index. It was supposed to be an industrials. Now we add Apple to the Dow after an unbelievable run, and we add it when it's the most expensive company in the world. Like, now it has some legitimacy when it gets over $500 billion market cap, which is beyond me. So I like to consider myself an expert, but I'm no more of an expert than the guys trying to calculate what companies should go in each index. And I think there's a lot of historical examples of where I think they've gone off track. So one of the things that we do is we look more for sector rotations. And I think when you look at the data that supports that, you know, if at the end of the year I told you, and just hypothetically, if I said, hey, the S&P 500 is going to go to 2,500. If I said something like that, I better be directing you what sectors are going to take you there. Because when you look at the historical data, the deviations between sectors, between the best sector and the worst sector from 1970 to present is 45% on an annual basis. Second best minus the second worst is 26%. So if I can get you overweight the two best sectors on an annual basis, you're going to perform your benchmark regardless.
And the irony there is that so many top professionals fail to even match, let alone exceed, the indices. That gives one an incredible leg up. Even just 1% or 2% over any period of time leads to almost exponential growth, a vertical asymptote. I really appreciate that induction a posteriori here regarding inclusion and exclusion of key components within the indices. We're not, as you say, looking at the same index from the year 2000, the year 2005, the year 2010, 15, 16. Maybe not so wise or prudent to then speculate on just what is simply not as relevant as it would be had they kept the same basket. Let's move on now to the precious metals. Several years after a remarkable 12-year bull market in the yellow metal, give us an idea of your targets, if you have any, and whether or not the precious metals will become a more savory index in the next 12 to 24 months, please.
I think that, you know, right now it's just not an asset that the world wants to own, obviously. You did become parabolically extended down. You did have a reflex rally, but you haven't broken those longer-term downtrends. I think the market would be much more excited about it if we broke those longer term downtrends, and until that happens, it's kind of a wait and see attitude. But every sign is there right now that it's capitulated. The question is are we going to go sideways and go into a trading range for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, or 12 months? And until it breaks out, we're not going to prognosticate what the price target is, because we need to have it form a pattern. And those patterns are going to be reversal patterns that you see on every chart. And it's going to be a head and shoulders bottom, a double bottom, triple bottom. It's going to be something that's very visible to every technician out there. But until we get those patterns prognosticating, you know, again, like I said, I don't do any time prognosticating where the indexes are going to go, because I think it's all about sector orientation. On the gold chart, until I get those patterns, can I really prognosticate where intermediate term moves are going to take you? Right now, I can visibly see it's extremely, extremely oversold. But we need something that is going to rejuvenate the desire for gold. And what that is, it's oftentimes you don't know what that is until it occurs. And it's going to have to be on a global basis. Right now, I feel that we're in much more of a currency war. You brought up an interesting comment earlier. It's my view that when you have a government that believes that they can tether a currency, the fallout and the corrections from that are so powerful, and they usually upset the balance of the market. And a perfect example was China tethering the yuan to the U.S. dollar, and all of a sudden having this, you know, untethering of letting it depreciate 4%. Another perfect example is look what happened to Switzerland when they untethered from the euro. It seems that everyone will tether it during a period of time that they don't want it to weaken too significantly, but when a currency strengthens too much, then they untether and you get these cataclysmic shocks because no one's used to it. And I think that's the problem with what we're seeing in the market, whether it's QE. We have all of this support that no one can determine when it's going to come off, what it's going to do, and what cataclysmic shock it's going to have.
Clearly, you are looking for signs of technical strength to re-enter the precious metals sector. Is there any area that I've failed to cover today that you would like to share as this dialogue winds down?
Right now, we're seeing a visible breakout of the euro against the U.S. dollar. And we've been underweight the U.S. manufacturing sector and those companies that have exposure to, you know, mainly Europe. But you're seeing that, you know, with the climb in the U.S. Dollar, it's put a disproportionate weakness on those companies that do business outside the U.S. With the change in the euro that we're seeing right now, I won't go as far as saying that we're going to see a complete reversal in the dollar versus the euro, but it does appear that we're establishing a bottom. Therefore, the wind is changing on some of those companies that do business in Europe, that you're probably going to see that the next quarter you're not going to have the magnitude of earnings decline based upon the strength in the dollar versus the euro. In other words, we're starting to see that wind vane change. And I think that's a good sign for some of these larger cap U.S. companies that do business in Europe. It's certainly a welcome sign, but one of the things that I, as a technician, I would like to see is some of those commodity sectors to stop going down. I don't need them to outperform. I just need them to stop going down, and this market could certainly get some gas under it. We're, you know, as you said, we're seeing levels of oversold nature. The percentage of stocks trading above the 50-day moving average, you know, we're sitting right around 8%. You don't see that number very often. It's commensurate with the low that we saw in March of 2009, commensurate with the low that we saw in June, July of 2010, 2011, and 2012. So we are at a level which we can at least stabilize, but in many cases when we have a sell-off like we did, we'll actually undercut the previous low, and we can do it by anywhere from 5 to 8%, and then we can form a bottom. In most cases, it's been a head and shoulders or a double or triple bottom.
And that's exactly what we see happening. In fact, I've never seen reading, even backtesting, quite as oversold now. And I'm trying to talk some of my colleagues back from the ledge, tell people more about the exciting services that you provide and what folks will find at Vermilion Capital Management's website when they click the links at goldseek.com.
What you'll find is you'll find some examples of our research. Most of our research is around a proprietary relative strength product that we've been doing for a number of years. Most of our work has been towards institutions, the large institutions. Have an extensive background in technical analysis. Our product is, again, it's relative strength oriented. You'll see some of the products that we put out there. We do a lot of sector calls, a lot of group calls. We have an international product that we're rolling out as well that looks at markets all around the world, broken into geographic and by sector and by group orientation. I think it's some of the only known technical research to this magnitude out on the marketplace. I think you'll find it fascinating, and I think it'll give you some great ideas of what's happening around the globe.
I want to encourage every listener to direct your web browsers over to Vermilion Capital Management. What a pleasure having you on the show today. It's just, as I said in the intro, a shame we haven't had the pleasure sooner.
Certainly. Thank you for having me on the show, and I appreciate it.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. The push and pull and massive change and market capitulation is upon us. The U.S. stock market has seen massive sell-offs this past week, attributed directly to China, with a minor rebound and then nothing. Listening to the famous Man in the Street mainstream talk radio interviews on the days with the biggest volatility and declines, it's as if people, including the reporters asking the questions, were momentarily awoken from their 7-year quantitative easing hypnotic sleep, just long enough to say they hoped it did not affect their 401k plan. The world has been lulled into a false sense of security the past 7 years by attempting to solve debt problems with more debt. The 2008 economic collapse never ended. It just moved into slow motion, like a tree collapsing. You hear the timbers snap, And part of the tree comes down and causes financial mayhem like it did in 2008. But what about when the rest of that tree starts collapsing? But the only difference is this time the whole forest has the ability to become uprooted and reset. We've entered that forest now. We entered it this past week. The financial change we have been anticipating, that some have been fearing, that others have been trying to understand and prepare for, is upon us. There are many in the resource community that I follow and respect. Let me name just three who have commented this week in the boldest of terms: Jim Sinclair, Greg Manarino, and Egon von Greyers, that what has happened in the markets over the past week marks the beginning of a systemic collapse that will have profound implications for not only gold and silver, but the global economy as a whole. Beyond the economics, I want to ask you if you are prepared, with your network of friends, your family, and are you located where you want to be geographically? Or are you going to wait and see if something really happens, and just how bad it is, thinking you can always get from here to there because I've got some gold or silver coins? Did you ever think that maybe there's some things that may not be able to be bought with gold or silver in a crisis? Did you ever think that maybe you should make certain plans and lifestyle changes now? The secret to conquering change is being prepared for it. This month marks my 8th year doing business and economic commentaries for GoldSeek.com radio. If there's something you've been wanting to do to prepare for yourself, your family, and your future, do something about it now. Insurance is cheap ahead of time, but is nearly impossible to acquire when there is any kind of economic smoke, and it becomes immediately unavailable when there is an economic fire. The forest we entered this week has the potential to become an economic firestorm. Are you ready? Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at conquerchange. Thanks, Chris.
today's special guest, Gary Dorsch. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome our featured guest today, Gary Dorsch, formerly with Charles Schwab and Company, now publishes independently Global Money Trends newsletter, and he's also an independent trader and wears many other hats and monikers. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, and glad to be with you today.
Pre-interview, you talked about the markets, and you know, we've seen a lot of volatility. I mean, yesterday our discussion with Peter Schiff included the recent yuan devaluation, the impact that had. On the whole, there are many disturbing events occurring in the currency market. Vietnam also devalued its currency. We're also hearing about, give us an idea of what you see happening here.
The issues that you just mentioned, the severe devaluations of a whole slew of emerging currencies and U.S. dollar strength against the G7 currencies is a very big focus of the market's attention right now. And last week's devaluation of the Chinese yuan was also a very big event, which is now having ripple effects even a week later as we speak. The significance of China's devaluation was that it caught the market completely by surprise. There was no advance warning of it. In the past, when China was shifting its currency policy, there was as much as 6 months to 8 months in advance notice of discussions about a possible shift in policy, which normally was due to massive pressure from other trading partners. But this was completely unexpected, and it represented a major shift in China's yuan policy. For the previous 10 years, China acceded to the demands of its trading partners to strengthen its currency. And over a 10-year period, the Chinese yuan strengthened by 28% against the U.S. dollar. At the same time, because the Chinese currency for the last year or so has been roughly steady with the dollar and almost pegged to the U.S. dollar, we saw the Japanese yen and the euro drop by 20% against the U.S. dollar over the past year or so. And so, therefore, the Chinese yuan also strengthened by 20% against the European currency and the Japanese currency, and almost 15 to 20% against the Korean, and also by dramatic increase against the value of these emerging currencies. The Brazilian real, the biggest economy in Latin America, has dropped by 53% compared with a year ago, and the Russian ruble down 80%, some of the more extreme situations. And therefore, China is becoming increasingly uncompetitive in the world markets, and its exports are collapsing and contracting for the first time. And this is a severe problem for China's economy, as it still depends on about one-third, its exports still account for one-third of its growth. So we now see what this devaluation meant was that China was basically admitting that its economy is hurting badly from this drop in exports, which is due to the adverse currency fluctuations against the yuan. So it aims to try to correct things by weakening its currency, but it's got a long way to go to catch up to the devaluations of the Japanese yen and the euro and all the other major currencies. Even the Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar have dropped by 20 to 25%, while the yuan was holding steady with the dollar, and they can no longer compete in world markets. So it's a recognition that China's economy is growing probably much slower than the official statistics would say. The government says the economy is growing at 7%. But now most analysts are saying it's probably somewhere in the 4 to 5% range. And you can see that by the collapse in commodity prices. Is the other part of this whole story is that the strong U.S. dollar is also exerting massive pressure on commodity prices. And today we're looking at the price of crude oil at just over $40 a barrel on West Texas Sweet, and North Sea Brent breaking under 50 now at 47. And for Bakken crude oil, Bakken shale oil, at $36 a barrel, putting most shale oil operators into below break-even levels. So massive pressure on commodity producers as a result of this strong dollar. And now if the yuan begins to decline, the yuan will put even further pressure on Asian currencies. and making the U.S. dollar even stronger. And today the price of copper, $2.28 a pound, and we're seeing a massive drop in the price of Freeport, the U.S. largest copper miner, and most importantly, dropping under $10 a share today, and its bond prices are collapsing, which means for the first time, bondholders in Freeport are concerned that the company may not be able to service its debt. And when you get to that situation, it's very severe. And we're seeing a lot of these commodity producers seeing their bonds falling substantially and raising their interest rates, which means the industrial sector is in severe trouble. And yet the Federal Reserve is preparing the market for an increase in interest rates, which can only support the U.S. dollar, I'd imagine.
First, I'd like to backtrack to your bullet point that officials in China are recognizing and they're starting to adjust expectations. Of course, we also saw the blow-off peak in Chinese equities and the Shanghai Index and related indexes there as well. So let's start off, if we could, with the greenback and just how you see the strength here. Is this an anomaly from your perspective? Are you on board with us that we may be looking at a more of a sea change event here in the primary trend?
For the next year or so, the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan are going to continue to massively print their currency through their quantitative easing schemes at a clip of about $65 billion worth of euros and $65 billion worth of yen every single month will be injected into the world markets, and that puts a lot of downward pressure on those on the euro and yen. Even if the U.S. was not to raise rates, which would force it to drain liquidity in order to sustain an increase in U.S. rates, the dollar would go higher when you have Europe and Japan actively trying to devalue their currency through QE. With the Fed now, I think we'll probably raise the rates by 0.25% next month, and that'll force it to drain some liquidity in order to sustain the slightly higher interest rate, which makes the dollar more attractive. The other key issue is that in the emerging world, there's trillions of dollars that are owed in U.S. dollars by emerging corporations. They have to buy dollars in order to pay their debts, in order to pay the interest on their debt. And so they get very panicky and they're buying the dollar because they're worried that the cost of servicing that debt will increase as the dollar rises. So the Fed will probably take all this into account. My guess is the increase in interest rates by the Fed is going to be much smaller than in previous rate hiking cycles, no more than two increases from an eighth to a 0.625% by the end of the year, and then they'll see how things look. But if there's a lot of devastation in commodities and in emerging currencies, the Fed may just stop it right there and leave it there for quite some time. If you take a look at a 50-year chart of the federal funds rate, you're seeing that the Fed funds rate has been pegged at an eighth of a percent for 6.5 years. And I guess, you know, you kind of lose your perspective when after 6.5 years, people begin to think that an eighth of a percent is normal. It's not normal. It's highly abnormal. Fed funds at an eighth of a percent for 6.5 years. That interest rate was more appropriate for a time when we were losing 700,000 jobs a month and we were in a financial crisis. It's not appropriate at a time when the economy is generating 200,000 jobs or more a month for over a year and a half and growing at 2.5%, and auto sales are booming at record levels, and housing prices have gone up dramatically from their lows. So it's not appropriate. And people are, a lot of the reason you're hearing this objection to raising rates is a lot of traders have become addicted to the cheap money and they've made leverage bets, betting on cheap money. And so they will have to adjust their thinking accordingly. The reason the Fed will raise rates, if they do, and I believe they will, is they're going to follow the advice of the Bank of International Settlements, which said about a month and a half ago that higher interest rates were necessary not because the economy is growing too strong, not because there's an inflation problem. Higher rates were necessary to try to bring monetary policy back to some type of normality and to, most importantly, head off the possibility of even bigger and bigger bubbles in the equity markets. Because if bubbles grow in equity markets and then burst under their own weight because they're unsustainable, that can also do damage to the economy. So to find the happy medium, they recommended that the Fed start raising rates just a little bit. Then that will shake out some speculators in the equity markets. We're starting to see a little bit of that today. Yeah, at this point in time, most traders in the stock market, U.S., do not believe the Fed will raise rates. And so it will be a shock to them if they do. And we'll see how all that proceeds. But I believe the Fed will follow the advice of the Bank of International Settlements to normalize policy to a certain extent.
Well, I share those sentiments, and I think it's just obvious if you actually read through the headlines and just the commentary from the Fed itself that they mean business here. This is not a bluff. I think it would absolutely destroy any credibility that they have left were they to backpedal. This, of course, assumes that we don't see a massive 10-20% decline in equities or, you know, let's talk about this junk bond market. There's been some talk from several different sources, Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, the Economic Collapse blog, massive increase in yields that we've seen. The last time there was increase of this magnitude, I think we could look back or hearken back to 2008. We all know how that ended up. Why don't we delve into whether or not you see any similarities between 2008 and today?
I'm looking at a lot of junk bonds on my screen right now, and they're all pretty much in the energy sector. Those are the ones I look at every day. And the $1 trillion junk bond market, about a quarter of that's in energy companies. A lot of those companies started exploring in the shale oil industry here in the U.S. and borrowed money in order to fund their development, and they did not expect the price of oil would be at $36 a barrel for shale oil. About a year and a half ago, or just over a year ago, was over 100. Of course, if it stays down here for an extended period of time, these companies are going to start burning cash, burning liquidity, and their bond prices are already dropping significantly, and their cost of borrowing has already gone up. This is where the major danger lies, and in other producers, even Freeport BBB rated bond is now seeing its bond prices fall to 97 cents on the dollar. They were just about 110 cents on the dollar a few months ago when copper was trading at a higher level. It's never exactly the same, but sometimes history does rhyme, but never exactly the same. I believe a few years ago, that was all kind of triggered by the banking sector, the crisis in the banking sector, which would have led to a big cutoff of lending for all companies. This is kind of more specific just to the commodity resource-based companies for now, as far as the threat to the junk bond market.
Let's move on then to the precious metals sector, mining companies. We all know we're back in, by many metrics, to sub-year 2000 levels. Just because things are down, as we all know, they can remain lower for an indefinite period. Give us an idea of what you see in this sector, maybe if there's any silver lining.
I often kind of remind my readers that the two biggest buyers in the world are China and India, so we have to kind of consider economic conditions there, the mindset there. And then I think the other major factor behind the gold market is the general trend in commodity prices. I don't trust government statistics on inflation. I don't think many people do, but I've always used the trends in commodities as some type of leading indicator of where inflation might go. The U.S. CPI uses commodities or goods-based components for about 40% of the CPI, but in India and China, commodities can make up anywhere from 60 to 65% of their consumer price index, what most people buy every day. And in China right now, the producer price index is down 5.4% from a year ago, mostly reflecting the drop in commodity prices, and the consumer price index up 1.6%. And even in India, which had a big inflation problem of about 9 to 10% for consumer prices, that's now dropped down towards 4% and is sort of declining with the downturn in commodities. So investors in gold in those two areas are seeing declining inflation, and were more inclined to buy equities and trade the stock market than they were to trade gold in order to stay ahead of monetary inflation. It was a big shift in investor psychology in India and China, where they started plowing money into stocks. We saw both the Bombay and the Shanghai stock market go up dramatically while gold prices were falling. And I felt those traders in those countries were shifting their psychology, which was a major shift, and preferred to buy stocks. Now they're getting hurt in the stock markets there, and so they don't quite know where to go, but they're not running back to gold so quickly. And in the meantime, the price of gold here has dropped significantly, as we all know, briefly under $1,100 an ounce. What I typically do when I show the price of gold, I always show the year-over-year change in commodity prices. And right now, the equally weighted commodity index put together by Thomson Reuters is trading at 396. That's below the key 400 level. That is down 22% from a year ago. That's an equally weighted basket of 17 commodities, and as we've already talked about here, a copper at 228, and there's also severe weakness in agricultural commodities and corn and soybeans and wheat, and sugar, 1061. I believe that's about a 10-year low. And of course, the energy complex and the coal complex and ethanol all under severe weakness. And beyond that, iron ore and natural rubber in Shanghai all significantly weaker. The there's not much inflation out there, and these downturns in the commodity prices have also had a negative influence on the gold market. Now, gold has rebounded here by about $40 or $50 an ounce in the past few weeks. The rebound was triggered by China's devaluation of the yuan. If you go back and look at the chart, that's the rebound began when China made its devaluation. So there is some factor there. I think the thinking is, if China is going to try to weaken its currency, it'll need to buy some U.S. dollars in order to do so. And once it buys the dollars, what will it do with the money? In the past, it's always put a lot of it into U.S. treasuries, but the hope is they may diversify and maybe buy some gold instead. I think that's kind of the reasoning behind this recovery in the gold market. So if China does devalue its currency further, and I believe they'll be under pressure to do so, given the severe weakness of their economy and the misalignment of the yuan with other currencies, the thinking is they will continue to buy some gold as to diversify. On the other hand, the upside is sort of limited because of the severe weakness in commodity prices and what looks to be a general trend of a weakening global economy due to the with China leading the way down.
On a more forward-looking basis, let's project forward 12 to 18 months. Where do you see things headed from here?
Well, it's also important to realize the top eight gold miners in the world have been able to reduce the cost of production, their all-inclusive cost of production in the last few years. One of the biggest costs is energy, and that's dropped dramatically. And they're also benefiting from weakening local currencies. The average break-even cost for the top eight gold miners is now about $950 an ounce. They can sell gold at $1,000 an ounce and still make a profit. Although about half of the world's gold miners now have a break-even of probably closer to about $1,150, and they're losing money at current prices, they may have to start cutting production at some point. All that means is essentially, I think $950 would be a floor for the gold market. And I think the lowest you would see gold possibly go over the next year or so would be about $1,000 an ounce. Gold miners can still make money at that price, the largest eight. But many are losing money right now and may be forced to cut production, which is a supporting factor. I think the upside for gold would be about $1,200 an ounce with support at $1,000. So I'm giving myself a $200 range, and I don't really see it going outside of that range. If the Fed does raise rates two times between now and the end of the year and dollar gets stronger, The price of this rally in the gold market could fizzle out at around 1170 or so and then go back down towards its most recent lows of 1080 and possibly slightly lower down to 1050. So that would be my projection if the Fed does raise rates. If the Fed does not raise rates, if it gets cold feet, if it gets worried about what it's seeing around the world and doesn't raise rates, then the gold market will hit the upper end of that range, I would predict, around 1170 to 1200. So that's kind of where it's all at in that regard.
Well, my current target is 900 to 1,000. You know, I'm a huge proponent of the precious metals as an excellent portfolio balancer. They do that better. Anything else? I'm sure you're watching all kinds of interesting developments here. Any topicality that I've left out that you feel is pertinent to the listening audience today?
I think we've caught a lot of it as far as commodities and currencies are concerned. My prediction is that if the Fed does raise rates, as I suspect, and we'll see the euro drop towards a dollar even from about $1.10 today, and the dollar will go from about 124 Japanese yen up to about 130 yen, and the emerging currencies will fall even further. There'll be a lot of severe weakness in foreign currencies if they go forward with that. That'll keep a lid on the commodity markets and the gold market. And that's, that's the million-dollar question, which everyone will be speculating on. Will the Fed go forward with what they've already telegraphed, or will they get cold feet at the last moment? So it'll be great drama going into that September 16th to 17th meeting. My guess is they will go for an increase in interest rates because the goal here is to head off bubbles in the equity markets, and there are quite a few of them in the NASDAQ market for sure.
Particularly the S&P 500 is just loaded with parabolic charts, actually some, I think, approaching vertical asymptote. But even though momentum, I think, is starting to pull back, I think investors are going to be surprised. You know, the shorts are going to be surprised. For instance, during each subsequent pullback that we've seen on our favorite seven indicators here, sentiment indicators, and what that typically means is this bull market may still have some upside in the next year or so, because typically we would see a very high level of, as I mentioned, complacency and bullishness during each pullback if this were really a market top.
Well, there's a lot less liquidity in the market. The trading volume has dropped by 20 or 30%. One reason is a lot of investors have switched to ETFs, exchange-traded funds, and instead of diversifying into many different stocks in their portfolio, they just buy one stock. And so for that reason, there's fewer shares that are traded, and there's therefore you often see the market making sharp moves, and it's really kind of deceiving because there's just not much volume behind it. And then things just sort of reverse on their own. So in other words, also be aware there's a declining amount of volume in the market, and therefore subject to wider fluctuations than otherwise, and a lot of meaningless noise. The high P.E. ratios are mostly in the NASDAQ stocks, and you have a concentration of just six or eight stocks that are holding up the entire S&P 500 right now. If you look at the up and down volume for the day, or the new highs, 52-week highs and 52-week lows on any given day, you will see anywhere from two to three times as many companies ending lower for the day than went up, even when the market goes up, which means that the broad market is actually weakening, and there's a lot less breadth in the market, and therefore this is not a very strong rally, and it's sort of just being kept up by a few companies. We'll see the true face of the market. As far as the stock market is concerned, we'll only see the true face of the market when the Fed starts to normalize its monetary policy and gets us off the 0% policy. That's where we'll see how things pan out. Historically, the first few interest rate increases don't really knock the stock market down significantly. There may be sharp downward moves for time beings, but they come back quickly. They see the increase of interest rate as a sign that the Fed feels confident that the economy is strong enough to stand on its own 2 feet. And so they can spin the news as being bullish. But at some point, if the Fed does continue to raise rates, if they were to move them even higher next year, towards 1.5% or 1.75%, then I think 10% to 15% correction in the stock market at that point.
Gary Dorsch, I wonder if you wouldn't mind telling folks a bit more about Global Money Trends, your newsletter, and any contact information you'd like to leave with the listeners today.
Actually, I am speaking to you from my townhome in southern Florida, and this December will be the 10th year anniversary that I've been writing the Global Money Trends newsletter. It's a unique newsletter. It gives readers an opportunity to see charts and graphs that you can't get elsewhere on the internet. And I focus a lot on intermarket technical analysis. I like to show how different markets affect each other. As an example, I'll be putting up a free article on my website at searchartsalot.com. You can also go to globalmoneytrends.com to see the article, and you'll see as an example a graph of the German DAX index overlaid by the value of the euro versus the Chinese yuan, and you'll see a very strong degree of correlation. And this devaluation of the Chinese currency against the euro has had a negative impact on the German stock market. So I explain why that is the case, and just gives readers a greater understanding of what's moving all these various markets. And I cover a lot of territory. I cover a lot of the currencies and commodities and interest rates and discuss all these matters with a lot of very interesting charts and graphs. You can get a good idea of the type of work I do by going either to searchartslot.com or globalmoneytrends.com. And
Gary Dorsch, we appreciate your thoughts. Look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Thank you very much, Chris, and best of luck to you in the markets, and thank you very much.
It's great to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's featured guest, Peter Schiff from Schiff Gold. Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, located at schiffgold.com, author of several bestsellers and a radio host. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Great to have you with us, and I thought we could start off today with China's yuan. They cut their yuan rate against the U.S. dollar for the second day.
I think this is much ado about nothing. I mean, you know, the Chinese yuan rallied substantially with the dollar, so the yuan has been very, very strong, like the dollar, over the past several years, and I think the Chinese were more concerned about the yuan's exchange rate versus all the other currencies, and so they slightly reduced its value. Ultimately, I think they're going to reverse that, and the yuan's going higher. I think maybe it's a good sign of a capitulation on the part of China that, you know, they finally decided to do something when I think the dollar is actually turning. The euro right now is moving back up to 112. The euro is up about 3% against the dollar in the last 6 days or so. You know, gold's having a big day today, not only against the yuan, but against the dollar. In fact, I'm looking at gold stocks. They're up 17% in the last six trading days, up 5% today alone. So maybe we're seeing a change here. You know, the Dow Jones is now down over 200 points today. It was falling. It had its longest losing streak in 4 years before the Chinese took action in the currency market. Doc, I think what's happening in the stock market is for a long time people thought it was okay if the Fed raised rates because the Fed was saying we're data dependent and we're only going to raise rates if the economy is strong. Well, the economy is far from strong. It's rapidly decelerating into recession and the Fed is still pretending that rates are going to go up. So maybe people are starting to brace for higher rates in a recession. But, of course, that's not going to happen. The Fed's going to call off the rate hikes, and when they do, gold's going to go ballistic.
I think there's a case to argue that the markets have already factored in, obviously, the rate hikes that are probably will in September and December.
I wouldn't bet on that because they always say they were data-dependent. And so they can always come out and say the data didn't justify it. You know, they've never promised a rate hike. They simply said that if the conditions warrant it and the data, is there, that they'll move. But, you know, if the stock market keeps falling, They don't want a bear market in stocks. How are they going to stock the stock market falling? The Dow Jones is now down about 6.5% from its highs. I think if they don't do anything, if they continue to posture as if there's going to be a rate hike, the Dow could be down 10% over the next week or two. So it would be down 10% from its highs, so another 3.5%. If the Fed doesn't do anything, then the Dow could be down 20%. It could be down 20% before September. Are they going to let a bear market? Because a bear market is a pretty good forecaster of a recession. And in fact, most of the economic data that we have is so bad that we've never experienced it outside of a recession. You know, the economy is the weakest it's been in the entire 6 years of the recovery. How is the Fed going to kick it when it's down by raising rates?
Isn't there a moral hazard that the Fed governors face if they do back away from the September, December quarter point rate hikes? You know, we're looking at probably about a half a point if they continue with their current plans. If they do, they're setting, a dangerous precedent.
The U.S. problems are worse than ever thanks to the Fed. If the Fed were to raise rates, we'd have a worse financial crisis in 2008. Well, the Fed doesn't want that. So the Fed's going to do QE4 for the same reason they did QE3, for the same reason they did QE2, right? Because they have no choice.
Peter, I'm with you. I mean, if you look at the St. Louis Fed's numbers on the Fed's balance sheet, clearly preparing for the next injection. But QE is not interest rate related. Because gold, you know, it's so sensitive to interest rates. Gibson's paradox, we learned that, just a basic law there.
But higher rates are not going to hurt gold. I mean, what's hurt gold was the anticipation of higher rates. So when rates finally start to go up, you know, gold will start to go up also. But, you know, I don't think rates are going up. That's the problem. See, gold is sold off because everybody thinks rates are going up. When they realize that that's not happening, gold has a lot of lost ground to recover, right? And even if the Fed, and this is why I don't think they're going to raise rates, if the Fed raises rates to 25 basis points or 50 basis points, and then the market tanks or we go into recession, what are they going to do? I mean, they're going to lower rates back down to zero? You're not going to get much bang for that buck because that's not a big rate cut. They're going to have to launch QE4, but they're going to look pretty foolish if they raise rates and then have to bring them back down to zero. I think they look less foolish if they leave them at zero the whole time, because raising them and then cutting them is an admission that it was wrong to raise them. So why would they want to risk looking like they made a mistake? They would rather stay at zero and then look like they were smart not to raise them when they launched QE4, as to look like they got it wrong. Right? They'll look a lot worse if they have to raise rates and bring them back to zero than if they just leave them at zero the whole time.
But, you know, I'm not sure that I buy your premise that the Fed sits around watching the Dow like Hank Paulson all day long. At least, you know, their gibberish, their Fed speak, seems to indicate they're watching two things, inflation and employment levels. And both of those are right in line.
Well, look, they can't tell the truth, right? So they have to make stuff up, right? They can't tell people how bad things are. But look, the inflation numbers are all doctored up, and the Fed probably knows it. You know, and the Fed wants inflation because they want to wipe out debt. They just want to inflate away the debt. But the jobs numbers are a joke. The Fed knows this. The unemployment rate is meaningless at this point because we've eviscerated the labor force. We have the lowest labor force participation rate since 1976. We've got the lowest homeownership rate since 1967. You know, why is it that so few Americans can afford homes? Because they don't actually have jobs. They're not in the labor force. The unemployment rate means nothing because so many people who should be considered unemployed are either out of the labor force and not looking for work, or they've accepted a part-time job. So if you used to have a real job, right, let's say you were an engineer and you were getting $75,000 a year, and now you're making, $6,000 a year.
You talk about how the government's employment number is meaningless, but I think it's an excellent inverse indicator or to gauge just how wrong and upside down the figures really are. We're looking at roughly 100 million Americans out of work, especially if you include the underemployed, because after a year or two, you just drop out of the workforce altogether. You're no longer considered a statistic.
Yeah, and, you know, that's why I think the weekly unemployment claims are so low, because you can't be fired unless you're hired. And so if very few people are getting hired, then it stands to reason that you wouldn't have a lot of people getting fired. And that is the real reason that we don't have the normal amount of unemployment claims, because we don't have a dynamic labor market. We don't have people getting hired, getting fired, getting rehired. That's not going on. You know, but I do believe that a lot of the people who did get hired in the last 4 or 5 years are about to get fired, you know, because employers were gearing up for a recovery that isn't going to arrive, right? They've bought into the hype. Just like, look at the inventories. The big driver of GDP last year, apart from all the money we wasted on Obamacare, was businesses building up on inventories because they believed that the customer was going to be able to buy their stuff. Well, they're finding out now that customers are broke. The inventory to sales levels are the highest they were since the Great Recession of 2009. So now you have all these businesses that have all this merchandise that they can't sell.
But, you know, at the same time, there's still these issues, even though Greece just struck another deal, I think it was. There's still plenty of issues in the Eurozone, which is directing huge capital flows to our shores. Do you see that trend continuing?
I mean, I see it turning. I mean, look at the euro is now above 112 again against the dollar. The euro bottomed out in March at 105. So for all the problems that they have in Europe, the euro is rising against the dollar. And, you know, even with the turmoil now, whatever people are worried about in the foreign exchange markets with China, the euro is rising. It is very strong against the dollar. The Swiss franc, this is probably one of the biggest up days I've seen in the Swiss franc in a long time. The Swiss franc is up more than 2% on the day. You know, the last time I think it was up this much was, you know, when they broke the peg against the euro. You know, of course, it was up a lot more than 2%. But since then, I think this might be the biggest up day I've seen in the currency.
Do you see that as a protective play? I mean, people are running for safety nets and whatnot when the franc is kind of known as that safe haven.
Yeah, it's a safe haven. And look, if people, maybe some people are starting to put two and two together and realize that the Fed's not raising rates. And the thing is, if they can't raise rates now, they can never raise rates. That is the problem. We went through an entire recovery without the Fed raising rates. In fact, if you just looked at the data, right, if you didn't even know like what year it was or where interest rates were, if you just looked at the data and they presented the data like on an econ exam in a typical, you know, U.S. university, and the data was there, and then the question was, what is the appropriate monetary policy? The answer would be reduce interest rates, right? Based on all the things that are happening, the Keynesian play would be reduce interest rates. But they're already at zero. How could you reduce them? And they're pretending they're about to raise them.
No, I'm on board with you. I mean, the monetarist play here obviously would be you have to reduce interest rates. Otherwise, you're going to face a sea change of inflation, just a whirlwind of inflation down the road. That is the playbook. It's a page torn right out. But now we still have to face the reality that they believe these numbers, or at least they pretend to. If we take a look at the precious metals, you seem to think we might miss the exact bottom. You know, maybe dollar cost averaging here might be a better play.
The bottom may already be in. That is the, you know, people waiting for that, you know, absolute low. Oh, I want to buy under 1,000. They may never get that opportunity. You know, and in fact, if you look at where gold is right now, I mean, gold has risen rather sharply. I mean, the low on gold was about 1080, right? I think the low I saw. And right now we're at 1,124. So we've already rallied almost $50 off that low. So we'll see. I mean, you know, if we get back above, I'd say if we get back above 1,200, I mean, you could forget about buying gold below 1,000.
So the miners, the huge rally we've seen just today, 5%, I mean, they can do that. I mean, they're highly leveraged. There is some concern, though. Some of the miners could start hedging again because we've had lower prices for so long. That was an industry practice for over 20, 30 years. And I'd like to know if you're thinking about that, if that's in part of your mental processes here and how that might impact the markets.
They can't even mine properly. Most companies can't even mine gold profitably at 1,200. So how are you going to hedge it? I mean, maybe if gold goes to 2,000 or 2,500, some people might hedge. But there's a lot of companies that can't even mine gold properly, profitably at 1,400 or 1,500. See, when they were hedging gold back in the 1990s, you know, they could still make a profit with $300 gold. You know, so they didn't want to run the risk that it went down to 200 because they were profitable at 300. But most companies aren't even profitable today at 1,200. That shows you how much inflation there's been because it's a lot more expensive to mine gold today. So gold prices would have to be much, much higher before anybody would even consider hedging. I mean, hedging could bankrupt the gold company. You know, imagine that. Imagine you hedge the price of gold and the cost of mining keeps going up, but you're locked into your hedges.
So with all the short selling mayhem that we've had to all endure, every one of us probably most of the people listening to our voices today in the sector, in the XAU, in the HUI, then would it be safe to assume that the more established, larger caps might be the safer play because they don't have to deal as much with cash flow issues, debt, limited debt options, and things of that nature at these levels?
The big blue chip companies with better balance sheets are certainly well positioned, to survive this bear market. Some of the real smaller companies, of course, have gone bankrupt in this environment, a lot of the junior miners. But ultimately, you know, the ones that survive are going to thrive because, it's going to be a huge bull market. Nobody expects it. I think the interesting thing is you've got hedge funds for the first time ever net short gold, and, they're stuck at the lows. And this could be the biggest short squeeze ever. And the problem is, when the shorts have to buy the gold, where are they going to get it? That's going to be the key. I mean, there's not a lot of gold for sale, certainly in the physical world. What I'd like to see is some of the people who really want physical to get into the futures market, buy some contracts, and then take delivery, because that will be a game changer if some of these paper owners actually decide they want real gold, because the people who have sold the gold don't have it and can't buy it.
Well, speaking of buying gold, the latest report from Peking, from China, regarding their gold imports, the largest gold producing and consuming nation now, or at least in tandem with India. The numbers were a little bit more tame than many of the folks in the gold crowd had expected. I mean, I don't know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 tons in their stockpiles. It looks as though that might be a low ball figure.
I was talking about that at the time. China's been lying about how much gold they have for years. And now they come out with a number, and everybody believes that all of a sudden they're being honest. They're still lying. They knew what they were doing. They were like, hey, how can we get the gold price to go down? Let's do something that will be interpreted as negative. So let's tell everybody that we own less gold than they think we own, because we haven't updated our ownership in years. So let's update it, but we're not going to update it completely. We'll just move the needle a little bit. And that's what they did, because I'm sure the Chinese have a lot more gold, and we're going to find out how much gold they have when they, when they announce that their currency is backed by gold.
We're both gold aficionados, huge fans of the market, and you've certainly tossed your hat into the ring here. I mean, this is the primary focus of your services. Can you help the listener today who is battle-weary and concerned that we could be facing another 1980 to year 2000, two decades slogging through the mire? Help us to get past those concerns, please.
That is not the decade. We had the huge bull market in the 1970s. We're still in that era. We're not in the bear market, because that was, interest rates had got up to 20% in 1980. So we had, 20 years of that falling interest rates and rising stock prices. And, we're not in that environment. We're in a 0% interest rate environment. Rates aren't going any lower because they're already at zero. Inflation is going to run out of control. There's no way to stop it. We had disinflation from, 1980 to 2000. The inflation rate was gradually coming down over time. Now it's going to be going up. So this is a very different environment. This is more like the 1970s, which was very lucrative for the gold owner. And I think this is going to be even bigger potentially than then, because the U.S. is in much worse shape than it was going into that decade. And I think the problems are much bigger. And I think the resolution is going to be much more, catastrophic as far as the dollar's exchange rate goes and the price of gold.
So you would say then that due to the debt-related issues, and there's really no other way other than to continue piling this massive QE-related debt onto balance sheets around the world, that ultimately this leads to a huge bubble.
We have multiple bubbles. We have a stock market bubble. We have a real estate bubble. We have a bond market bubble. We have a dollar bubble. The whole U.S. economy is one gigantic bubble. The Fed is going to keep blowing air, but ultimately it's the dollar that has to go, because the only way to keep all these bubbles inflated is to sacrifice the dollar. And of course, when you sacrifice the dollar, gold's going to skyrocket. I'm just waiting for the Fed to come clean, or I'm waiting for the markets to figure out the Fed's game, right? That they've been bluffing the entire time, and that there is no rate hike and there is no U.S. recovery. And that's the game changer, because that's when the dollar implodes. That's when gold explodes. That's when everything turns around. And yes, I know people who have been buying gold for me, my brokerage clients, have been frustrated these last few years because the markets have been telling us that we're wrong. But I know that we're right, just like the markets were telling me I was wrong when I was predicting the real estate bubble or the dot-com bubble. The markets are wrong until they figure it out. And maybe we're getting closer to figuring it out, this big drop in the U.S. stock market, this big drop in the dollar, this rise in gold that's going on right now. This may be telling us that this is the beginning of the end.
Okay, but let's say that the idea here doesn't come to pass and they do pull the trigger twice. Is it two and done?
If they can even get one done, which I don't believe that they will. I think they're going to have to call off the rate hikes before they do it. I mean, you know, the Fed's plan was to try to, you know, have their cake and eat it too, right? To pretend that they can raise rates and pretend the economy was strong enough to withstand the rate hike, but never actually raise rates and prove that the economy was too weak.
Back in 2008, however, they did have a big gun over the Treasury Department, obviously Hank Paulson. Do they have the leadership this time to manage another 2008-style credit crisis?
Well, I don't think we're going to have one, because I don't think they're going to raise rates and precipitate one. We're going to have a currency crisis. And, of course, they don't have the tools to manage that. Right? There's nothing that they can do, you know, because ultimately, if they have to jack up interest rates dramatically. You know, Russia had to bring interest rates up to 17% not too long ago to defend the ruble. Imagine what would happen if we had to do that to defend the dollar.
All right. Please tell folks more about the services you provide and any contact information that you see fit.
Sure. Well, we do sell gold and silver. And, you know, you should buy it quick, you know, before the price goes up. You know, we had a record month last month. I think we sold more gold than we have in years. And I'm glad that my clients were smart enough to buy it. But keep buying, because, you know, prices are still low. The sale is still going on. But, you know, I'm not sure how long the window will be open at the for sale counter. You know, don't wait for gold sub 1,000. Just buy it, you know, sub 1,200 is good enough. You know, right now, as I said, it's around 1125 or so. But buy your gold and silver. Silver's still way, way down, right? It's back above $15, but it's not that much higher. So buy some silver. You know? And then, you know, this is a chance to use your overvalued dollars before they implode to invest in Switzerland, Singapore, New Zealand, you know, the countries that I like, that I think have got their act together. We're buying stocks and bonds for our clients at Europe Pacific Capital. You should check out europac.com, EuropoC.com, europac.com, and talk to one of my brokers about how to protect yourself from this coming dollar crisis.
Are you then expecting a change in mentality? I mean, right now it's mostly a paper asset related mentality. I mean, all they're interested in is risk and technology. Is that going to change?
It will. People are paying ridiculous prices for pie-in-the-sky, hope and dream, tech stocks or social media stocks or biotech stocks. Meanwhile, gold stocks are the cheapest they've ever been, or they were, in the history of gold stocks. I mean, last week you could buy a lot of gold stocks for lower prices than they were in 2000 when gold was under $260 after a 20-year bear market. That's how cheap they got. The sentiment was worse this time than it was back then.
All right, Chairman Schiff, we do appreciate your time and continued success.
All right, thanks a lot.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. An article appeared on CNBC this week in which Vice President of the St. Louis Fed, Stephen Williamson, was quoted as saying, "There's no evidence quantitative easing boosted the economy." In a white paper titled, "Current Federal Reserve Policy Under the Lens of Economic History, a Review Essay," Williamson has dissected Fed policies which began in 2008 and 2009 and criticizes the Fed's approach and the lack of results produced. Before I comment further, there is likely only one reason for this kind of report on this subject at this time. It is anticipatory of the next crisis. And if the Fed can be seen as quasi-objective and introspective, so the next round of money printing can be repackaged and resold as new and improved, The criticisms will have already been hurled from within and will likely cancel out many of the objections for whatever the next action steps will be, which have probably already been decided and are sitting on the shelf waiting to be implemented. But I digress. Williamson asserts the zero interest rate policy, which was supposedly designed to spark what the Fed calls good inflation, resulted in the opposite. He says their forward guidance statements have confused investors, and monthly debt purchases under a variety of acronyms that have increased the Fed's balance sheet to over $4.5 trillion have had at most a tenuous link to economic improvements. He wrote, "There is no work, to my knowledge, that establishes a link from quantitative easing to the ultimate goals of the Fed, which is inflation and real economic activity. Indeed, casual evidence suggests that quantitative easing has been ineffective in increasing inflation." However, the one place where he says the Fed has been successful at increasing inflation is the stock market, which is up 215% since March of 2009. Another area of criticism is how the Fed has systematically moved the goalposts and equivocated on when it was going to raise interest rates, such as its original 6.5% unemployment number. And now, as he calls it, we're at a 5.3% headline unemployment rate, and the central bank is still nowhere close to raising interest rates. This white paper is actually a brilliant strategy. With the Fed criticizing itself from within, it will not need to listen to any outside criticism when the time comes to implement a new and improved policy of quantitative easing, or whatever it will be called the next time around. And with the Dow in its biggest sell-off since the financial crisis began, and Sir Alan Greenspan warning us, a little late as usual, this time about a bond market bubble, Stephen Williamson's just-in-time critique of the last round of Fed interventions may be perfect timing to help cancel any lingering objections for what will undoubtedly be the next round of even more aggressive monetary interventions, for what will undoubtedly be an even more severe economic crisis this next time around the world over. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, I hosted a series of teleseminars on gold and the economy, and will soon begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change.